Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com.
My guest today is Hermione Eyre, journalist and winner of the Kitschies Golden Tentacle Award, winning Folio Prize nominated and Walter Scott Prize shortlisted Viper Wine, a fabulous novel about alchemy and indulgences and the quest for beauty, which is ostensibly a historical fiction novel, but one that's bursting full of speculative elements that I really, really relished. Hermione, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Thank you for having me.
Firstly, I'm going to ask you to tell us a little bit about your novel for the people who haven't read it. It's not enough for me to say I loved it. What's the elevator pitch?
Do you know, I'm slightly resistant to those, so that's why it doesn't trip off the tongue as it should.
Then give me your version of it.
Yeah. Viper Wine is a hallucinogenic potion, which is also a beauty potion, and reading it is rather like taking a trip to 1632, right before the English Civil War. So I suppose that's, you know, in a nutshell, how it begins.
And trip, of course, being the operative word here, because everything is a little bit trippy, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, for me, the best way of connecting with the past was through creating ruptures. So doing what I wasn't supposed to be doing in a historical novel actually strangely made me feel much more connected to the English Renaissance courtiers and their very beautiful wives being painted by Van Dyck. You know how to make things fresh for oneself as a writer helps keep things alive and actually make the past feel more accessible.
Viper Wine itself, how fascinating is that? Just the idea of this beauty potion itself fascinated me. Where did you come across this for the first time, since I believe it is based in fact?
It is. So I was interested in Sir Kenelm Digby, this Renaissance courtier, and really a man slightly adrift in time already before I exacerbated that tendency of his in my novel. He was already a cameo in an Umberto Eco novel. He was known to scholars of the English Renaissance as a very serious philosopher, Neoplatonic philosopher. But he was also known as the man who invented bacon and eggs for breakfast. So he has all these different identities through time, and those are just a few of them. He crops up a lot. He's one of those very busy people, and one of the things he was also known for was creating this beauty potion for his wife, ostensibly, although I believed that women had perhaps more self-respect, self-determination than to go straight to their husband to ask for their beauty preparations. So I put my own psychological spin on the myth about Sir Kenelm and Viper Wine.
There's lots of great, many modern anachronistic references in Viper Wine too. Not something you'd expect from a story, usually, as you were saying, set in the 17th century. You were trying to make it fresh, trying to make new, as you said, creating ruptures as well. I mean, you have Andy Warhol giving some, you know, art advice, casually. Naomi Campbell's sort of cautionary beauty stories. And when did you, or why did you decide to switch up things by adding in these particular elements? I mean, was this ever in your mind going to be a straight historical novel?
Oh, yes. I tried. I did attempt to keep on the straight and narrow. But the impulse to introduce what I would call red herrings, the opposite of an objet trouvé, an objet perdu, sort of floating through time, like a wagon wheel, a strange piece of biscuit, which...
Right. I've had a wagon wheel.
Yeah.
I love wagon wheels.
Yes. Yeah. It's a strangely corny, but quite suggestive name. I like it. I mean, the great gospel is to stay away from brand names because obviously they don't really last. But I think I tried to choose names which are just evocative on their own. There's a certain kind of jingle to your ear. You know it's not from the 17th century, I think, even if you don't know precisely what it is. And I think, these anachronisms gave me a real a sense of, they were almost like a jarring feeling of bad taste, which I found quite electric. And I think a tasteful historical novel just it has a stultifying feel to it sometimes, and I really wanted to just keep it fun for myself, essentially. And then I think where what's fun for the reader becomes what's fun for the writer becomes fun for the reader.
In all the pop culture references in Viper Wine, there's lots of music too. I mean, there's the Yellow Submarine, so the Beatles come in, there's Bowie, there's Joy Division. Why these names? I pick up on them because I listen to a lot of music and I write about music, but was this ever, you know, based on your own musical preferences, or was there sort of a soundtrack for the book that existed as you wrote it?
I think music is so, how would I put it? Because music is structured around time itself, I think the idea of a rhythm and a beat and it's another way of accessing the past. The idea that there would have been breath in the mouths of people living in the past and their hearts would have been beating, and music. So music somehow I found thrilling as a way of getting into the past, and pop culture references that felt quite mischievous. And I was trying to recreate the coolness of my character. He would have been a real man of his time, and he was respected, but also there was a kind of frisson that attached to his name in the 17th century court. He was a bit of an explorer and an adventurer, and he was a dubious figure. He's neither Catholic nor Protestant. He goes between the two. He's a bit edgy, and I felt he might just get Joy Division, you know?
Yeah.
I just, it's kind of counterintuitive, but in fiction, I think you're entitled to go with that.
And yeah.
To put opposites together felt like the way of getting a fictional truth, because
yeah.
The actual truth is inaccessible to us because the real story happened so long ago. So the fictional truth perhaps comes through asking people to believe the unbelievable. So I really had fun along those lines.
He was never going to be a Britney Spears kind of guy, was he?
No, I mean, often people say, oh, you know, you push this book too far. I would have preferred it if you'd left out Andy Warhol. But that's what I quite enjoy. I like perhaps riling people just a little bit. And I don't think that, I think in a way, if you've riled people, that means they've engaged enough that you've sort of begun to get a proper relationship with the reader. And maybe, you know, I'm quite a well-behaved person in real life, but perhaps the impulse to be a bit like wrong and to be told off in a novel felt right somehow, perhaps to do with being, you know, I don't know, a female writer writing about a very male atmosphere in the 17th century. To be mischievous felt like the best way to own the story.
And speaking of, you know, pushing the envelope as it was, your book was, you know, you won the Kitschy, which is usually considered a sort of a speculative genre award. You were shortlisted for a historical fiction prize, a literary prize. And I mean, so do you at all define your own writing, Viper Wine obviously specifically, in any particular genre at all? Is that something you think about when you write? Did you at all consider that?
Mm-hmm. I do think I consider it, whisper the word, but I suppose it is literary, in that I think all literary fiction is often pushing at genre boundaries and doesn't really commit to either one or the other. And perhaps, you know, in some ways I'm slightly parodying historical fiction, but in other ways I hope to be stretching it. And it would be conceited to say I'm pushing it, but I felt like I was really trying to sort of worry those genre definitions. And I am absolutely delighted to be in the speculative camp as much as I am in the historical camp. I mean, I didn't necessarily write deliberately to push those buttons. It just came from a very interior place. I wasn't thinking about how it might be received or which shelf it might sit on or who, you know, which sort of subgenre might take it to their hearts. And so I feel extremely lucky that it has rung those bells. I'm really, really pleased. But that was a retrospective thing. And I think, you know, I think if you're writing to with the idea of a market, then you're maybe not doing literary fiction. You're doing a more commercial enterprise. And unfortunately, I didn't have the smarts for that.
Maybe next time.
Maybe. Yeah. I would just, from the heart, to be honest, I just was kind of trying to actually, I have a very strong relationship with these historical characters in my mind, and I was really trying to engage with them in all sorts of crazy ways and be true to them. So I wasn't really thinking about the market. I think perhaps that's when more exciting things happen. I don't know.
So what was your research process like? At which point did you put away the history books and, you know, just start making stuff up? And you were saying the gestation of the book took some years, 5 years, you mentioned just earlier.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of grounding you need to do. I mean, I studied that period at university, and I got quite into the writers of the time, but I still had to do a lot of research into costume and the works of Ben Jonson and masks and just general culture of the 17th century in order to forget it and totally mess with it afterwards. So maybe that's why the process was quite long. What do you want to know about the research process?
Well, I assume it was, as you said, it went on for a while, but was it just books? Did you physically go visit places? Did you, you know, talk to people?
Yes, exactly. That was quite exciting, actually. That was going to Sir Canon Digby's home, which is still standing in Buckinghamshire, taking a sneaky photo, which then actually I put in the book because I like having... because just when people think this is ridiculous, this is fiction, you can then ground it by showing them an artifact. And I quite like that that kind of questioning dialogue of what is true and what isn't all the time, really. So for me, going to the place and picking up the atmosphere happened very late in the process, but was a real joy. And unfortunately, you can't visit their graves because they were destroyed by the Great Fire of London in 1666. So it was that was after the year after Sir Kenelm died. So
any of their family still alive who you had to sort of, you know, worry about coming at you after all this?
Interesting question. No. there are Digbys, and I did make contact with them. And a sufficiently decorous period of time has passed that I can take liberties and nobody's actually going to be upset, I think. I was a little bit worried about a more minor character, Olive and Endymion Porter. They are, because I did actually, I implied some rather transgressive things about their relationship. So I even at a distance of, you know, 300 years, I was still slightly nervous about that. But I think people at that distance, people know that their ancestors have kind of become common cultural property, I think.
So I recall reading a review somewhere that said your lead female character, your main female lead, Venetia, is basically a 17th century Kim Kardashian. What do you say to that?
Wow.
I thought it was very funny, and I guess in some ways true.
Yeah, I'm delighted. I think if Kim Kardashian's, if what she has could be summed up in a, it's a kind of eternal feminine thing, I think, isn't it? She's the subject of so much fascination and rumor, and she projects herself and her many different, preoccupations so cleverly. And I think we've always seen that. And yes, because Venetia's not specifically about Kim Kardashian, I was kind of writing before the relentless rise of Kim Kardashian. So I really like that it's the next it's the next it girl. And the cycle just carries on repeating itself. And if I can suggest that type of woman, without explicitly naming her, that's a good thing. I don't know if there's any other fiction about her. Is there?
About Kim Kardashian?
Yeah.
I don't know if I would know this. I'm really not. I mean, this is the first time I've actually thought of Kim Kardashian being fictionalized. But you know what? I'm scared, but there's probably all sorts of fanfic on the internet.
Yes.
Ooh. If you are brave enough to Google it, do let me know. I don't know what would come up. I mean, it could be like this horrible downward spiral, this like rabbit hole you never come out of, reading fan fiction about Kim Kardashian.
Well, I mean, you know, it's postmodern, isn't it? It's I don't think of Viper Wine as deliberately postmodern, but obviously we all live in this postmodern society where like the most elevated forms of culture need to be can freely be compared with the kind of most disposable and like you know, so-called trashy, and there's no, you know, the difference is there to be argued. It's there are no divides that necessarily anymore, I don't think.
Yeah. Now, I know I can't take everything that Wikipedia tells me seriously, but I have to ask you, were you really a child actor?
Yeah.
What was that like?
I don't know how that got on there, because it's not something I mean, I have written about it as a journalist. I have, you know, I've sort of discussed that period of my life. I was sort of, you know, between 7 and 9, and then my career was over. Imagine.
Short and sweet, right?
Yeah. Retired at 10.
Who doesn't want to be retired early?
Yeah. No, the dream. I'm still getting repeat fees actually for some of the work I did, which is really good parental management, I think. I think thank you to my mum and dad for kind of giving me that rather special experience as a child. It was it wasn't something that I you know, they didn't let me get the stressful side of it. They didn't push me, but they kind of thought it would be fun and quite stretching, and I think it was. It was an interesting experience, and then I went back to, you know, I never left education or anything, so it was always under control, as it were.
So you stayed on the straight and narrow throughout?
Yes. it wasn't. Luckily, there was absolutely. It was all about the experience of filming and getting to know how that felt. And there was no attendant hullabaloo, or like certainly no fame or interaction with any press or anything, which is a whole other issue. And I'm very glad I was spared that at a tender age. Sure. So I was in Jeeves and Worcester, which was...
You know, I love Jeeves and Worcester!
It was in an adaptation with Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry, yeah. Which was... really fun, and I was in an Edith Wharton novel which was made into a feature film, and I was in a BBC documentary. I played the young Agatha Christie. So these were all really, really interesting jobs with a kind of literary edge, actually, yeah. which I found so fascinating as a child, and I felt really, you know, serious about it. I took it really seriously. I remember saying to Hugh Laurie at one point, like, no, I can't play a game between takes, because he was being sweet and trying to keep me entertained. I was like, I need to focus. Oh. I really need to, you know, and it's this sort of terribly, you know.
So earnest.
But yeah, I know, awful. But it was, you know, it was all.
And a croupier. I mean, that is fantastic. How did that happen? How do you go? I mean, I'm assuming you went to university and then you became a croupier?
Yeah, I left Oxford and I went straight to the casino, and my parents...
Because that's what you do. You go to Oxford and you go straight to the casino. This is the way of child actors.
Yeah. I think, you know, writers need to get out there a bit and live slightly different lives if they're going to have anything to write about. And it didn't delight my parents. But at the same time, they were hugely tolerant, because I think they knew... that they respected, I think, that it's really hard work to be a croupier. So it's like, okay, if your kids are working hard at something weird, at least they're working. You
right.
know what I mean? So it is dealing blackjack and roulette from 9 p.m. till 5 in the morning is really tough. And I wasn't up to doing it for more than a year. And I was taking, you know, furious notes the whole time and generally sort of... viewing it with quite a writerly eye, which is a bit embarrassing looking back, but the whole experience was amazing. And one day I hope to make use of it in fiction somewhere.
Do you have any crazy stories from those nights?
No, it was extremely pedestrian actually. One thing I did enjoy, which was you had to fingerprint your way into the casino through the, like, you know, the backstage, because large amounts of money obviously mean security is tight. But when I was doing my fingerprint, somebody said, oh, don't worry, it only responds to a finger that is live and attached to your hand. Oh. Nobody's going to cut
it. It's good to know.
Yeah, that was a really reassuring moment, yeah.
And of course, you've also been a journalist and an interviewer for quite some time. Are you still doing that? Have you kept up the day job?
Oh my goodness, the shoe is on the other foot now. Usually I'm in poor position, so thank you.
I'm going to take some tips from you after this. I've read about some of the people you've interviewed. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I've been very privileged to meet very interesting people. And usually I do think it's harder doing things over the phone. I think face-to-face contact does make it easier. So apologies for not even having an image on my Skype. The interviews I do very much fed into the book, because I tend to interview extremely beautiful actresses for, you know, glossy magazines, and to sort of see them in close and the power of their presence and their strange predicament, not being allowed to age by society or by their industry. And so it was very suggestive to me in terms of the fiction. The fictionalization of Venetia Stanley, this famous beauty who nobody would permit to age, just then, just as now. But also I interview artists, so, and I love going to their studios and talking about their process. And I really, artists are often really wonderful to interview, because just to get that insight into how that work is produced, because they're doing so much thinking, and it's often to have them unpack the thinking that goes into their art and to see a bit about their lives really helped me with making Van Dyck, the character of Sir Anthony Van Dyck, who is a very mysterious figure. There's not much known about him. You know, there are biographies of him. They're full of gaps. So I had to do some imaginative work there. And having interviewed some artists like Grayson Perry or Sir Howard Hodgkin, or who else have I done? Matt Collishaw or Polly Morgan, the taxidermist, people who've kindly let me into their studios and really talked to me. I found that very helpful to give me the confidence to create the character of Van Dyck. Oh.
Who is the single most interesting person you've interviewed?
Oh, impossible question. Who is yours?
Who's my impossible question? You! That's my answer every time. It's you.
No. I think it's strange, isn't it? Because when one approaches an interview, you bring quite a lot of baggage of your personal heroes. Or, you know, I've always loved Kenneth Branagh since I was a child, and I've managed to interview him, and that was a great personal moment. It wasn't a very memorable interview. And as an interviewer, I always try to it's not about my feelings. I need to ask the questions that the readers of the magazine would want to ask, not the questions I want to ask. So you'd have to try and keep yourself out of the interview a little bit, and I feel a duty to sort of bring people. I don't do aggressive interviews. I try and bring the best or the unseen side out of a person quite gently and quite sensitively, I hope. And I think people often respond better to that. So favorite interviewees, often it depends what happens during the interview. So sometimes it turns into a real encounter. Like when I interviewed Joanna Lumley, I don't know if she rings any bells. She's a sort of favorite British actress.
Yes. Everyone knows her.
A very, quite a sort of traditional comedic type of actress.
You forget I'm from a colonized nation. We know all sorts of things about Britain.
Okay.
Wagon Wheels and Joanna Lumley included.
Joanna has reached Karachi. Amazing. I wouldn't doubt it. No, so I was interviewing her in Sheffield, and somebody at the next table dropped a gun, which in England is just completely never happened.
Right.
Because guns are just never seen apart from...
Not like America, yes.
Well, yeah. It was a very strange moment, especially because she was appearing in Chekhov and the Cherry Orchard, and
right.
t- talking about the gun and that, and then it sort of happens, and she was absolutely amazing. She was so brave. I went to go to get some crisps. I actually thought I ought to call the police. And when I came back, she'd gone over to him and was like chatting to him and trying to find out his life story. And so it's, I love just watching celebs in unusual circumstances like that, and just trying to observe them so keenly that I can just relate that in the piece rather than grilling them or putting them under any, you know, that there's all that false pressure in so many interviews these days to make headlines and right. to get that view of something, and it's just all rigged. I don't like those kind of interviews. I try and just discover I try and never to extract information like getting a tooth. Do you know what I mean? I do the soft.
So how's the second novel pressure coming along? Is there some? Is there any? Are you managing sort of day job and this?
I am very tempted to do something very, very, very different, and I think perhaps that's to do with Viper Wine being so much sui generis. That's a word I write but never really say, as in it's not obvious how to. That another book would at all be the same as it, because Viper Wine is such an eccentric book. I can see that. And so a new project might be less. I want to try and use my confidence to write something much more to the point. And Viper Wine is a sort of excursive novel of ideas, and I want to do something that's very interior and very immediate and sort of vital. And perhaps that's to do with being, you know, having a small child and being in a different frame of mind. I don't know. Novel number two. Do you know, I'm in no hurry. And I don't think it serves readers very well when people get straight on with churning out the next one. I think it's good to gestate books for as long as they need to be gestated, as long as what comes out is really worthy of people's time and can really transport them. That's all that matters. You know, the winning the Golden Tentacle was an absolute dream come true, and it's on my mantelpiece now as we speak, and I'm extremely happy to see its strange golden waving tentacles, and it does cheer me on as I work on novel number two.
Well, I'm very excited for whatever it may be, which is the only reason I asked. But hopefully we'll speak again when it's, you know, out in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.